Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, we're going to be talking about a controversial yet often ignored topic of sexuality, open relationships. In a world of committed couples, why don't we think more about the temptation to open things up sexually? How do we separate love from possessiveness and begin to enjoy sex in abundance with a bunch of different people? We'll be joined by Janet Hardy, author of the book, The Ethical Slut, a practical guide to polyamory, open relationships, and other adventures. What are the boundaries of open relationships? How do you deal with jealousy and attachment? And most enticing of all, how can a committed couple like yours today be safely and successfully swinging tomorrow?
How many people consciously make the choice to be monogamous? Hardy isn't here to convert you, but to share the enlightenment and obstacles that come with multiple partners. And how do they get past some of the practical issues, such as raising children in a polyamorous household? Put on your seatbelts. This show is gonna sizzle.
Janet, welcome. Let me start off with the first question.
Okay.
You started out in a monogamous relationship, lasted about 10 years.
Yep, actually, the first 10 years of it were monogamous, and then I slipped with it. But yes, my first relationship was monogamous.
What went wrong, and do you think that you were actually matched right with this person from the very beginning?
I don't believe that for most of us, the idea of being matched right with one person for the rest of your life is likely to work out very well. I mean, it does for some people, but you're not the same person at 20 as you're going to be at 40. And the chances that the two of you are going to change in the same ways are, you know, they're not huge. So my answer to that would have to do with the fact that we married. I was 20, he was 21. And he was the right person for that first decade of my adult life.
He was. And was the sex good?
Not great. Not dreadful, certainly, but not what I wanted. But, you know, when you're just getting started on your life, you're having your kids, you're building your career, sex is not a top priority. You know, you've got other things on your mind, and so you should. And that was kind of our situation. The sex was certainly adequate. But as I got a little older, the career kind of got into the groove. The kids didn't need me so much, you know. They were still young, but not babies anymore, not toddlers. Then all of a sudden, well, not so sudden, gradually, I started to want more. My desire for kink in particular was becoming much, much stronger. It was something I hadn't had much awareness of at 20. But by the time I hit 30, I had sort of figured out what all that was about, and I really wanted it.
Which kind of kink were you into?
BDSM. Okay. My first several books were about BDSM before Dossie, and I did The Ethical Slut. So that's kind of a core sexual orientation for me. And, you know, I didn't know that at 20. At 20, I literally thought I was the only person in the world who got off thinking about spanking. And so I didn't get it that there were other people around that I could do that with consensually until I was in my late 20s, which is, you know, hard to believe in this day and age where it's all over the television. And
yeah. Did you ever discuss it with your husband, by the way, the kind of
turned you on? Yeah, we did. We did talk about it, and we did try it, and he wasn't into it. Okay. You know, some people aren't. there's a bell curve on this, like all other things. And he was at one end of it, and I was at the other. So that was probably the primary cause of our breakup, was just this really core sexual incompatibility. But we had just moved on. We had gotten into a sort of pattern of compensating for each other's weaknesses so that growth was not happening. And I think we both got to be better people once we weren't doing that for one another anymore.
This is a huge question, but how does polyamory work? You say it's a stabilizing force.
It can be, or it can be destabilizing. I don't think you can make any truisms about polyamory always being anything.
Yeah.
But you know, what do you mean? How does it work? Do you mean logistically? How do you make it happen? Or
well, you talk about the various constellations it takes. I mean, you know, there's group marriage, there's multi-partner relations, there's these, there's open marriage, swinging, consensual, inclusive relationships, triads, quads, trisexual. I mean, you know, there's so many variations of this new paradigm of love. And I just wondered how successful, I know that there's probably only, 1 to 3% of people who are actively involved in polyamorous relationships like this. But I wonder how they get structured. How do they really work for people?
Well, a mistake I see a lot of people make, and others might not think this is a mistake, but I do, is that they draw a picture in their head of what they want their relationship to look like, and then they go out looking for people that they can make that happen with. I'm more in favor of the sort of opening your life to whatever people come wandering into it that you click with, and then building the relationship around the needs and connections that you make with those people. So instead of, you know, something you hear about a lot in poly circles is couples who hunt for what's called unicorns, which is, it's typically a heterosexual couple looking for a bisexual woman to make a triad with. And, you know, the odds of finding exactly the right bisexual woman are, you know, they're not great. But if you simply get out there, meet people, it might turn out that the person that you click with is a guy that you're going to form a V with, or it might be another couple, or it could be almost anything.
It's kind of like playing the lotto. You don't know what you're going to hit.
Well, exactly. Or it's not really that different from a monogamous partner seeking, where if you go out looking for someone who's over 6 feet tall and has blue eyes and makes better than $80,000 a year, and the lists that people make for themselves, you're closing yourself off to a huge number of possibilities that are out there, and you might form a different kind of relationship with
Janet, you called yourself a gay man who happens to have breasts and a vagina. Why that expression? Curious.
Since I can remember telling someone when I was like 17 that I felt like a gay man in a woman's body. So it's an identity that's been with me a very long time. I'll be 60 next year. So
Mazel tov.
Yeah, thank you. So it's been with me a long time. The men I've dated throughout the years, I've dated a huge number of either men who are already gay identified or men who have come out as gay while I'm with them or shortly after. I'm now with a guy who is bisexual but has spent a great deal of his life in the gay community. It's where I feel most comfortable. I don't care for the power dynamics of heterosexuality. I don't feel at home there. I'm not a terribly feminine woman, so I don't fit in very well in the heterosexual world. I just feel far more at home with gay men and around gay men.
How about women?
I love them. I love women too. But I tend to relate to women as though I were a man.
Well, I think your point about sexual fluidity was very interesting. I mean, Lisa Diamond I've read, and her idea of female sexual fluidity is quite fascinating. I mean, women are more apt to be attracted to women and men than men are.
I think we're seeing it coming up more and more with men as well, as the new generation of young men is coming up who are not so terrified of the idea of being gay. I'm seeing a lot more sexual fluidity among younger men as well, which makes me very happy.
Jen, I want to ask you a question, and I'm asking it because I really want to understand how you use your words.
Sure.
You use, in the term of the book, the ethical slut.
Yes.
Why do, what makes it ethical? I mean, why are you just not a slut? What makes it ethical?
The ethical part has to do, well, the number one with not lying, with telling your truth to everybody who can be affected by it. That's the a number one aspect of the ethics of sluthood. But there's also valuing people as human beings, not trophy hunting, not sex collecting, not using people, but accepting them fully. That's the other part of the ethical puzzle.
Yeah, but don't you underestimate the effect that you might have on someone? The fact that you may cause someone to fall deeply in love with you, and therefore the balance of your ability to detach and to open yourself up to multiple opportunities still can leave a person a victim, because in the beginning, everyone agrees, you know what, this is just about sex and connection and experience, and I like you as a person, and why not? But isn't there still a greater chance that when you bring sex into a relationship, it creates an emotional bond?
I hope so. Well, I wouldn't want to do it if it didn't. There are people who do sex purely for recreation, for the physicality of it, and they tend to identify as swingers. And there's nothing whatsoever wrong with that. It doesn't happen to be the way I'm wired. So if I'm having sex with someone, I want to love them, which may or may not be the kind of love that means I want to spend the rest of my life with them. There are a whole lot of different ways to love somebody. And I just finished writing a scene for my new book, actually, about a phenomenal experience I had some years ago where I was on the East Coast teaching a spanking workshop in a town where I'd never been before.
A spanking workshop?
A spanking workshop, yeah. And I met a young woman there who wanted to be spanked, and we did a scene together that just opened my heart and hers too. We were so connected. It was love. It was totally love. And it was just the for the night. But I've never seen her since.
But that can be very disruptive. I mean, in a relationship like that can touch off a really deep emotional reaction. It can be a real violence of the soul, a real seizure, like Carl Jung said.
It can certainly be, and the reason is that we've all been raised in a world where feeling love for someone has a path that's connected to it that has to do with, first we date, and then we date exclusively, and then we move in together, and then we get married, and then we have children, and then we have a joint checking account, and yada-da-da-da, and that's what we seem to mean when we mean love. But a huge part of ethical slothood is recognizing that there are all sorts of ways to love someone, and very few of them have anything to do with that particular path.
Well, there are two questions, though, I have, meaning why then use the word slut rather than I'm an ethical lover? Meaning slut, actually, when you hear the word, it has a negative connotation.
It certainly does, and we want to reclaim that. Slut means, usually in common parlance, it means a woman who has a lot of sex.
Or a guy.
And since we don't think there's anything wrong with having a lot of sex, we don't see anything wrong with being a slut, and we want to put that right out there. In the same way that people have reclaimed words like dyke and fag, we want to reclaim slut, because we think being an ethical and skilled and loving slut is a fabulous thing to be.
I want to ask you one question, and it's getting to the heart of the issue here, and that's jealousy. I read that 80% of polyamorous have experienced this and worked through it. And you've given that an awful lot of thought in your book, and I wondered if you would explain compersion and ways of working through jealousy, because, you know, basically some people are more desirable than others. I mean, that's just a fact of life. And I wonder how you deal with that.
I'm not quite getting that. You jumped there from jealousy to relative desirability, and that's a separate issue that I want to set aside for a second.
So jump into the jealousy issue.
All right. Well, what I meant was, let's say that you form a deep, emotional, irrational passion for some person. Mm-hmm. And that person, instead of responding to you in the same way, finds someone else who is considered more attractive in our culture or to her.
Okay.
How do you handle that rejection, that sense of colossal loss?
Well, I don't really see this as a poly issue, frankly. The story you just told me is a story that mostly gets played in monogamous culture, where you only get to have one person at a time. Poly culture, there's no reason why they couldn't be sleeping with both of you.
I think jealousy, though, to be honest with you, and people are jealous because it is the concept that as man evolved, humans were not known for being monogamous, and they probably were not. But as society evolved, monogamy became more and more a part. Now, maybe it was because of religion. Maybe it was because that it was easier to run governments and have stability in economics. But there is something to be said about the depth. You know, when you use the word love, it seems so quick, such a transaction. You met that woman, you loved her, and she's gone. To me, that is just an experience. Like, I took a roller coaster ride and I loved it. I saw a movie and I loved it. I think the word is being cheapened. But tell me how you feel.
I'll differ with you on that. Okay. I reasonable minds can disagree on that.
Of course.
I see real harm in devaluing all the kinds of love that someone can experience that don't look like Ward and June Cleaver. There are a million ways to love. I took a series of Tantra workshops at one point where part of the instructions we were given at the beginning of the workshop were, in the course of the workshop, you're going to have experiences that feel like you're falling in love with the person you're interacting with. And you are. Where that's going to be a problem is if you try to project that into the future and make it be something that follows this cultural path. I'm paraphrasing here because I can't remember exactly how the Tantra teacher said it, and hers was better than mine. But if I were to block myself off from all these phenomenal experiences of love because this is a person that I don't want to share a joint checking account with, what would I miss? You know, Dossie and I like to point out we've been lovers, friends, collaborators, co-authors for upwards of two decades now. We've never lived together and never will. We would be wildly unsuited to living together. If we had tried to force the relationship into this culturally accepted pattern of what it means to be in love, we would have lost what we have.
What about this, though? What about you take a person who is in a relationship, married or unmarried, and they are there for one another in every sense of the word. Everyone's a friend until you need a dollar or you get sick. And they're there for one another through thick and thin. Mm-hmm. And then one night, one of the partners goes out and says, you know what, I had a great sexual experience and I feel like I'm in love with that person. Don't you think that creates a lot of emotional pain for the other party?
Yes. And what I don't understand about jealousy, you know, as I move through my life, there are going to be things that make me furious. There are going to be things that make me very sad. You know, I lost my mother a year or two ago, which, you know, I had great grief. And when I'm sad or when I'm angry, there's an expectation that I will do what it takes to get past it. You know, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life feeling angry or sad. I'm not going to blame someone else for my feelings of anger or sadness. I'm going to get over it, whether I need therapeutic intervention or a massage or to unload on some friends over a drink or whatever it takes for me to sometimes just tincture of time to get past it. And jealousy is the same thing. We've somehow set jealousy on this pedestal as being different from any other difficult emotion we might experience, as something that it's somebody else's job to fix by changing their behavior.
No. I think jealousy is a disease, personally. But I think that there's a difference between jealousy and what one could say is a deep commitment to another person, and therefore the welfare of their feelings is a part of that commitment.
One of the things we talk about a lot in The Ethical Slut is the agreements that people make with partners when they engage in poly. And a lot of those agreements have to do with that kind of priority. If your first partner is having a terrible week at work and really needs someone, shoulder to cry on, and you've got a date with your other partner, what are your obligations?
Well, how can you guarantee that that person is going to subscribe to this program? I mean, love, desire is famously irrational, as I keep saying over and over again. I mean, throughout history, it's always been associated with the demonic, with magic. It can sweep you off your feet. It's a neural hijack. So how can you guarantee through this frontal brain activity of sitting down and making rules and regulations that somebody's going to subscribe to all that?
One of the things we talk about a lot in poly is it can be called NRE, which stands for New Relationship Energy, or limerence. I'm sure you're familiar.
Yeah.
It's that crazy love thing that happens at the beginning of a new relationship. I actually did some research on it once, and, basically during that phase, that new relationship energy, your brain is being bathed in neurochemicals, and you're crazy and you're stupid, or irrational, as you put it, and it's not your most sensible time.
But it can last.
There are techniques for living through a partner who is undergoing new relationship energy, along with the understanding that there's some obligation on the partner's part to try to be as rational as you can while your brain is being bathed in neurochemicals.
I would think that would be really hard.
Also, the understanding that for the person at home while the partner is out with the shiny new thing, it's going to be tough. We all know it's going to be tough.
Yeah, it's going to be tough, I think.
Janet, what about how would this work, from even a legal perspective? If one is able to open themselves up to any sexual encounter, yes, it would be fun, but on the other hand, you're going to have people either never marrying, and you're going to have people not taking full responsibility for another person, because at the end of the day, taking care of someone with cancer is not as much fun as going to a bar and meeting someone new and picking them up and sleeping with them.
Well, I don't quite, there's so many layers to that one. It's going to take me a minute to tease them all apart. Number one, I don't see a marriage license doing, if a person is fundamentally not an ethical person who's going to bail when things get difficult, I'm not sure a piece of paper is going to stop them. I actually see poly as being a solution to this problem rather than an additional problem, because what I've seen over and over is that in poly communities, you get these little families formed by sexual kinship who band together to care for those who can't care for themselves. So when someone is in the hospital, instead of one person to come visit and yell at the nurses and bring the thing that needs to be eaten and so on, you've got four. There was a time a few years back, I was the one in the hospital. I was there for the better part of a week while they tried to figure out what was wrong. And the doctor who was taking care of me, we were chatting, and he asked what I did for a living, and I said I was a writer, and he asked what I wrote, and I told him about The Ethical Slut. And he said, that's not possible. And I said, you should have been here last night when my husband and my lover were sitting here on either side of my bed taking care of me. That's what you get, is I think in many ways what we're doing in a lot of poly communities is reforming the extended families that were commonplace in pre-industrial cultures, where you have grandma and aunt and grown siblings and so on, all living in the same area and collaborating on the tasks of life.
But Janet, you are an adult, very, very smart woman. You present yourself incredibly well.
Thank you.
What is the message, though, that we give teenagers and preteens who have raging hormones, not a brain in their head, who will be screwing everything that walks, not taking precaution? Meaning, how do we prevent that?
Well, not making them ashamed of their sexuality strikes me as a really good start.
Well,
I raised two teenagers. They're adults now.
I did also.
They were both, if anything, too conservative, I would say, sexually for teenagers. But, I don't run their sex lives. I would have liked to see them get out and around more. But, when they were pre-adolescent, we had the condom talk, and I put the box of condoms in their medicine cabinet and didn't do anything except keep an eye to make sure the supply was good enough. They knew they could come to me, and I gave each of them a list of friends who weren't me that could answer questions that they didn't want to bring to me because I, raising boys as a woman, I knew that there were questions they would want to ask a man. So I told them, which of my men friends would be okay with answering their questions. I gave them the number for San Francisco sex information.
So in a polyamorous society, what happens when someone gets erectile dysfunction or becomes aorgasmic? Are they alienated?
Not at all. There are asexual poly people, quite a few of them actually, who simply prefer to form their relationships based on something besides genital sex. They may want cuddling. They may want domestic partnership. There are all kinds of things to form a relationship around.
And these communities that you're talking about, these poly communities, mm-hmm. are all positive and harmonious throughout your research?
I think they do about as well as monogamous marriages do on average, which is not a high bar in this time in the world, but relationships are hard.
I mean,
that's bottom line. And if you've got two relationships going, then you square the number of mm-hmm. possible glitches that you might hit. For some people, it works. For some people, it doesn't.
What's the most number of lovers that you have ever had a polyamorous relationship with at the same time?
Well, you would have to define lover for me because it was
someone you're having sex
with. For a long time in my life that I had multiple people with whom I was doing BDSM that did not include genital sex.
BDSM, I see more as a fetish as opposed to an act of sex. It's sensual, it's arousal, but it's also, fetish as well, just like a fetish or anything else.
People argue for hours about whether BDSM is inherently sexual or not. So I'm just trying to answer your question fairly. If you're talking about people with whom I was having genital sex at any given time, I would say maybe three. But if you include BDSM that is erotic but not genitally sexual, then up into two figures easily. These days, none.
Well, I agree with you that monogamy probably doesn't have the future that we would hope. I mean, if 50% of people are unfaithful and more people are just living together, there's something to be said for all of these diversities of relationships that are cropping up. So I'm pro all of these new options. I'm just worrying about how they're going to fit any positive kind of paradigm, because even John Humphrey Noyes, and I think you write about him. Do you want me to talk about it or show you? But anyway,
it's not ringing a bell. I'm not sure.
John Humphrey Noyes. What I'm driving at is that your poly philosophy, which I'm very much interested in and respect, is utopian. And there have been a lot of experiments poly experiments in America, especially. And John Humphrey Noyes, in 1848, developed a place called Oneida Community.
Okay, so I'm familiar.
That's ringing a bell, right?
I didn't recognize the man's name, but I remember.
Right. And he thought the Second Coming had already arrived and that God wanted women to be happy in bed. So he collected all these men and he taught them chorizo so that women could have multiple orgasms. But the one thing that was forbidden there was what he called the claiming spirit. You couldn't be possessive of one person. Mm-hmm. Now, this thing lasted for 30 years. And Noyes himself got involved with a woman, and the claiming spirit struck him. He could not get her out of his mind. He couldn't make love with any of the women in the community. And the community eventually disbanded because men didn't want to give up their one special woman. So I'm wondering about this instinct that we have for a soulmate, for the one perfect person.
I think before you answer this, when you said the Second Coming, were you meaning that literally?
With Carreza, it would have been like the 18th or 19th, wouldn't it?
Just so I understand.
What literally?
My tendency is to think that what you're describing is new relationship energy or limerence. It doesn't last. How many people do you know who have been together for more than 2 years who are still feeling that way about each other, that sort of insane, can't think about anything else?
Oh, there's a lot of research being done on just those couples. So that who've kept that excitement and that first thrill through 30 years of marriage. So they're being studied right now under MRIs.
And I would tell you, I've had over 100,000 clients in 37 years of working 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. I will tell you that it's not a high percentage, but I will say it's about 3% of my experience that this...
Okay, let's just assume that your 3% is accurate. I'm not prepared to argue with it. I've seen it happen, not often, but I have seen it happen. Those people probably don't want to be poly. that's just not a good fit for them, and there's no reason why they should do it if they're happy with what they've got. For heaven's sake, it's a lot of work to be poly, and why would you do it if you've got something that makes you as happy as one of those relationships?
I guess the thing is why I would have a hard time with it is that people are naturally jealous. And again, I am not a jealous person.
Most people are naturally, not all.
Jealousy is not a huge issue. I didn't say all. I said most. And therefore, I see it being problematic for the children because children are the amount of jealousy that children have is almost 100% of children experience some sort of jealousy in the first 10 years of life.
Sure, of course.
Okay. So having the experience of being in a polyamorous community, I cannot see that being the most stable community for a child to grow up in.
Let me tell you about an experience of mine. Again, this isn't going to happen always. I do think that people who are poly and parents need to think seriously about how they are going to make sure that their children have a stable environment. They may want to be very careful about when they introduce new lovers to their children. They may want to see someone for quite a while before they bring them into the household, et cetera, et cetera. Because, yes, it is distressing to children if people are coming and going permanently at all times. The other side of that story is there's a man that I was lovers with many years ago. During a period, my sons would have been maybe 13 and 8 at the time, very roughly. And we were hot and heavy for a few months. I was in another primary relationship, but I was spending a lot of time with this guy. And he was over at the house a lot and friends with the other members of the household. And eventually, he particularly became friends with my younger son, at which point I ended the sexual part of the relationship because that seemed like a possible problem. But we stayed very close. Friends still are. It's been a long time now, 25 years now. And his friendship with my younger son is now their both core friendship.
Were you worried about pedophilia?
No.
Okay, so
I wouldn't be involved with someone that I couldn't trust around my children.
Okay.
No, they're very dear friends. They're on the phone with each other. Well, actually, because they're geeks, they're usually IMing with each other daily. They've been roommates off and on in the past. And that's, you know, in a pre-industrial culture, children tend to grow up in villages where they know everybody and there are multiple adults around.
No, I actually like that idea. But Janet, at what age do you think a child is sexually responsible to make a choice who they have intercourse with?
Introduce me to the child and I'll give you a guess. I don't guess who I think were pretty well set up and ready to make intelligent sexual choices at 14, and I know people who I don't think were quite ready at 30.
Do you think that there's a child that would possibly be ready at 10?
Not pre-existent, no.
Can I ask you a question about the poly community? And that has to do with hierarchy and power.
Yes.
How does that factor in? And the reason I'm asking you this is that I actually spent a year in a hippie commune, mm-hmm. and this was an issue. I mean, there was the alpha guy, and there was the alpha woman, and all kinds of power relationships that were destabilizing, I would say.
I think they're destabilizing when they're being fought. Certainly, it's common enough in dominant and submission relationships to have a conscious power hierarchy that works well for all involved, and it is not destabilizing. It is, in fact, what people are there for. But outside that particular realm, mm-hmm. I think some people prefer their relationships hierarchical, mm-hmm. and others prefer non-hierarchical relationships.
How does sexism factor in? Because throughout history, most poly relationships have been quite sexist. I mean, men with harems and the Mormon religion, for
example.
Well,
I was going to ask that. You know, what do you think about the Mormons?
Well, throughout history, most relationships, period, have been sexist. You know, monogamy, too. So I don't think that's a fair angle to take on it. You know, when you live in a sexist culture, relationships are going to be sexist. That's a truism.
Well,
I don't
not
think
every
it's
marriage.
But if you look at the people who are teaching poly and writing books about poly, almost all of us are female, and all of us are feminists. I think poly offers tremendous potential for feminist mm-hmm. relationships because of its flexibility, because of its choices.
But there are not as many men around as there are women. I mean, how do you figure that that disparity?
Not as many men as women in the poly community, do you mean?
Well, in society in general.
Men, in general?
Yeah. I mean, women are outnumbering men, and you've got maybe, you know, competitive catfights over these few desirable men. I mean, this is everybody's imagination about the poly community. I'm not saying it's mine. I'm just saying.
It's a hot fantasy for the guy, I'm sure, but I don't see it happening much.
Okay.
So let me ask this. So what do you think about, let's say, the Mormon offshoot where he could have 10, 12 wives, or the Muslim belief that one could have 4 wives? Do you see those as healthy relationships?
I think they can be. I think they often are not. Because both the Mormon, well, certainly Mormonism and some branches of Islam are a bit misogynist, that it's obvious that some of the relationships that are going to be defined by that religion are going to be misogynist. But I don't think there's anything inherently misogynistic or sexist about a partnership with one man and several women. I think.
How come? Yeah, because here's woman. Take women. Here, uh-huh. here are women, all of them, let's say 3 of them. And they've all got 8,000 nerve endings in their clitoris, and they're all high-powered sexually, and they've got one man who is not going to be as good a performer in bed, as Helen Fisher says, as a man. So she's not going to get her sexual due unless she's bisexual. In which case, then you've got something that's workable. But it seems to me that the women are getting the short end of this thing if a man has three or four wives. I mean, how can he give them all equal attention? It's impossible.
Yes, it is impossible just because there's only so many hours in the day, and some days he's not going to be feeling up to it, and other days he is. Some days he may be liking one of them more than the other ones. Any woman who gets old enough to get married and does not know how to take care of herself sexually, any man for that matter, mm-hmm. should not be married. Just in the same way as I don't think mm-hmm. People should get married until they know how to take care of themselves financially.
Mm-hmm.
Or socially, or any other way.
But doesn't that exclude, you know, again, I don't hold this belief whatsoever, but let's say a person is religious, and they believe that orgasm should be experienced within the context of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
How do we negate their religious beliefs, and why are their religious beliefs less valuable than ours?
They're not. What that means is that by the time you do get with your partner, you're going to have a hell of a charge built up, and you're going to probably get off like a rocket. And there's nothing wrong with more intensity and less frequency if that's the pattern you choose. I'm not into telling people they're wrong for making the choices they're making.
Mm-hmm.
If I can personally see, you know, yes, I'm bisexual, and if I were with several other women in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
I might like to be sexual with them. But I can also see, you know, I don't think sex is what marriage is for. You know, if sex were what marriage was for, then we wouldn't have marriage because sex is all over the place. Mm-hmm. I think marriage is for companionship. I think it's a business partnership to a large degree. You know, there's the functions of life that need to be shared in terms of owning property and in terms of ensuring successorship and so on. Those are all business functions. And I think it is about home. And I think nuclear families can feel very sparse in terms of those functions. It takes for two people to do all the work that is involved in relationship, home, children, all of that. It's not very many people.
I think though, I want to pick up on the last word you said is doing all the work.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think of the community, the kibbutzims or the Betsy and I both had experiences in living in communal settings.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it, the difference between a town and building a city. You know, I live in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and the commitment that it takes to build and run a city, yeah, there are more rules to it, but if you want to live in a city, then that's what it takes.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing is true of a marriage. If you want to live in a marriage, it takes a lot more work than it does to, to just simply go from one person to the other person, because you actually have to continually ramp up the dialogue, create new experiences. But I think that's what growth is all about.
But I don't like that word work.
Work, you know what? I don't like it either. I think it takes a lot more. You need to use your mind a lot more. You know, you need to explore because it takes mental acuity to say, how can I reinvent every single day more love in the relationship? You
right.
got to think about it.
Yeah, and fascinating.
And that's certainly terribly important and doesn't change when you're in a poly relationship. But there, you know, let's face it, there is work. There is logistics involved in running a life. And it is work. It's not fun stuff. It's doing the dishes. It's filling out the papers. It's earning the living. What I see as I look around me at the greater monogamous culture is this expectation that two people are going to be able to do all that and raise their children. And in this culture, which is in such terrible financial shape, usually both of them with careers as well. And I think a huge number of the social ills we're seeing are simply because there is not the time and attention to be given. no human being can work 8 hours a day and give good time to their children and give good time to a household.
Are you kidding? If I only worked 8 hours a day, I could build a skyscraper. At least 18 hours. But it's one thing I would agree with. I think monogamy is one of the possible solutions. I do think that in this country, monogamy is, first of all, my extensive experience is that monogamy doesn't really exist in marriage. It's quite rare. And when I say quite rare, I'm going to say over 80 to 85% of one partner has strayed within a relationship from my statistics, and that's over thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people. So I don't know what really the answer is. I do know that it does take, I feel, more out of you in a very positive way, that you get more out of yourself when you make a commitment to a person and you learn to reinvent that love each and every day. And I think there's a safety and a intensity that goes about it. The one thing that I have a problem with is that I like the idea of a community helping out, and very often couples have no real friends when there's a problem to go to. So, you know, you do make a lot of points.
Yeah, I think that part of the issue that we're dealing with here is the cultural expectation that a marriage is going to be the same thing all the way through, or a relationship, whether it's a marriage or not, which a lot of these expectations were formed in an era where people did not live nearly as long as we do. So
yeah,
we'd be talking
about
a relationship that lasted 10 or 15 years instead of 50 or 60. But the fact is that my best guess is that if we lived in a culture where people could pick whichever relationship style worked for them at the time without any social judgment about monogamy versus poly versus whatever, that most people, you know, the same as sexual fluidity we were talking about earlier in terms of orientation, most people would flow in and out of monogamy and poly as their lives changed. You know, most of us at college age, we want to explore, we want to be open to whatever comes along. So poly then, and then you get to the point of your life when you're having your kids, and probably monogamous then, and then maybe poly again once the kids are grown, and then maybe monogamous as you get older and your libido begins to die down a bit, and I think that would be a pretty common pattern.
Interesting. We have to go, Janet, but I want to say this to you. You clearly are an ethical person. Your honesty, your openness, your directness is so refreshing.
Thank you.
And impressed by you as a person.
Absolutely. I think your open spirit is so admirable, and I do think that marriage is going to be reinvented in the future. So you've made a good start.
And thank you very much.
I really
much.
Appreciate you coming on, and enjoyed your book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to talk to you both, too.
Thank you now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
I want to once again thank Janet Hardy for appearing on our show, and go ahead and pick up a copy of her book, The Ethical Slut, in bookstores today. Yeah, you could hide it from your partner, but pick it up. So, Betsy, could you see yourself in this situation? And where are the pros and the cons in your mind? Because I know there's some in my mind.
Yeah, well, I lived in a commune for a while, and okay, I was young, and at the time I wasn't happily married, and sure, I mean, there were a lot of sexy guys running around. But first of all, there was a whole lot of dissension in this community because some guys were more attractive and some women were more attractive. And the second thing is, I mean, as soon as I found the one, I just stopped being interested in anybody else. I just think this is a different strokes for different folks.
I kind of look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, mm-hmm. and I think that we're evolving into a deeper, more meaningful, more exploratory monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most marriages don't have what it takes to be successful monogamous, but I think it's the fault of both partners.
Gotcha.
You know, so that's my take on it.
Yep. Agreed.
I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. Buy Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction on amazon.com. They're entitled Seductress and Swoon, which is now out in paperback. And you know, when that's out in paperback, there's a reason for it. I'm sure you noticed the new music in the episode that was written by our very own sound engineer, John Alexander Busey. John's also a composer. He's a music producer who runs his own recording studio in Long Island. Check it out on Facebook, The Space Recording Studio. Search for it all in one word. Keep listening. Keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.